I'd like to begin by welcoming you to Tuesday evenings at the Modern. I'm Terry Thornton, Curator of Education, and it's nice to have you here tonight. I would like to begin by thanking the Arts Council of Fort Worth and Tarrant County for their support of Tuesday evenings. Tuesday evenings, for some of you who might be unfamiliar, is a weekly lecture series by artists and other art scholars, making it, to my mind, and I think you'd find some agreement in this auditorium, the Modern, the place to be on Tuesdays between now and November 18th. We are interested in our audience, and we really would appreciate, I know that you received a survey when you came in with your ticket, so we really would appreciate you filling out that survey to give us a better sense of who we are serving with this program. Many of you I feel like I know well, but it's nice to get the data, get it in on paper. For information on the series, I encourage you to visit the Modern's website. There you'll find the schedule and a description of each of the lectures, and you'll find the one for the coming week to be the one that's highlighted with the most information and an image. So that's how we're working it this year. If you go to that site, you will find that next week we have the artist Alejandro Sasarco here to talk about his work, and it gives you a website where you can find more information on him, where you will find that he was one of the representatives, one of two artists who represented your way in this Venice Biennale. Tonight, of course, is the first for the Fall 2011 series, and it is good, very good to be back, and off to such a great start with the artist, writer, and curator, Sean Dockray. Sean arrived here for tonight's lecture from Columbia, where he was installing and facilitating a public school project with collaborators Caleb Waldorf and Fiona Witten for MDE 11, which is a biennial of sorts of in Medellin, Colombia, before going home to Los Angeles, where Sean lives and works. I have to say that I really appreciate Sean taking time to be here out of his very busy schedule. It is the public school project that first alerted me to Sean and his extraordinary efforts that extend actually well beyond public school to other critical and innovative endeavors such as ARG.org and TELIC Arts Exchange, of which Sean is the founding director. Just a spattering of some very recent, and I mean very, very recent activity for Sean includes a new publication project, Contents, with Stephen Wright of Usership, which began in July. Participation on a panel titled Modalities of Change at the Warhol Initiative in San Francisco in June, which is then, of course, showcased on the Warhol Foundation's site as the part of a series of case studies. And that, of course, is the result of them having received grants from the Warhol Foundation. So they have that to credit to claim as well. Let's see. Also, archive agendas, recent discursive platforms in art and architecture at MIT and Cambridge, and the presentation Art as a Way of Knowing, which I have to confess I mentioned in this introduction because I really like that title, which took place last March. So you can see that I'm not going that far back, and I could keep going a long time with just the last 6 months. So this is a very busy man. In addition to the ongoing Encontro International de Medellin 2011, which I mentioned. Exhibitions for Sean have included shadowboxing at the RCA in London and a commissioned project for the 2010 New York Art Book Fair. Sean has also recently presented at Townhouse Gallery in Cairo and the 29th Sao Paulo Biennial, and his writing has been published in publications such as Cabinet, Volume, and Philip. And as announced, tonight's presentation by Sean is titled Exhibibility, Exhibitability, which is hard to say but interesting to think about, a reflection on the sometimes destructive threshold that he observed while running Art Space, as well as his own queries about alternatives to the exhibition model. So if you would, please join me in welcoming Sean Dacre.
Okay, can you hear me? Yes, okay. First, I want to say thank you to John, Michael, and especially Terry for inviting me. And it's a real pleasure to be here. And I've enjoyed my time so far. So I'm going to be reading. I kind of apologize for that. But I find that if I don't, then I always, at the end, really regret almost everything that I've said. So now I'll regret mainly just parts of it. So the title for my talk today is a mouthful, Exhibitability. And before I get into that, I want to make a couple introductory remarks or disclaimers. The other thing that keeps me very busy is this little girl. But first, I sent the title before writing the contents, which might be like naming the baby before you see what she looks like. Eventually, she's going to grow up, get mad at you about her stupid name, and change it. So it may turn out that this talk is about something else other than exhibitability. Sorry. Second, I have to admit from the beginning that I've never properly been to art school. I don't know why this is the slide for that. I've come close to it, and I even dropped in on it a couple of times, but in actuality, I studied civil engineering and architecture, and eventually design, a bit of an imposter program that renamed itself to include media arts. So this is me with some whips at a public school class. Being an imposter, that's the punchline. The question at the heart of this lecture, though, is how are things, objects, projects, or practices made public? And does exhibition exhaust these possibilities? And well, I wrote that, and then I was like, no, clearly the answer is no. Exhibition does not exhaust the various ways that things can be made public. Sort of a silly question. So perhaps the real question for me is, what does exhibition do to objects, projects, and practices? And what might other ways of making these things public do differently? So that's kind of the question, but I think I just end up really diverting a lot from that over the next little bit. So now I'm going to go back, take a diversion to Los Angeles in, got rid of that too soon, 2004, when Fiona Witten, Christian Moeller, and I were starting an artist-run nonprofit organization in Chinatown called Telic Arts Exchange. Christian dropped out shortly after to focus on his work. So mainly it was Fiona and I working on it. At that time, our focus was on artwork that used computation or the internet, usually in the form of video, sculpture, and installation. There were no other galleries in LA at the time that were showing this kind of work for three reasons. I'll just guess what they are. One, it often looked more like the stuff we see and use every day than art, so its status as art was sort of in question. Two was the market was thriving, which had the effect of stimulating the production of marketable and movable objects, like paintings and things. And this, for example, is by Davis and Davis, and it, you know, the size of the stage that's up here was the size of our gallery, and they built they built sort of a fake car with these animatronic heads singing a Johnny Cash song, Cry, 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 with this like mammoth backdrop, you know, of a classic photograph. And that sort of thing was really, really difficult to move, you know, in commercial gallery terms. Three, the work usually required a lot of technical assistance for its production, installation, and maintenance. Video projections are sometimes easy, but this, by Ed Coolidge, is a huge set of the, like kind of pneumatic tubes with a big vacuum that's blowing around one of those things that you put your money in at the bank, and it had a camera at the front with a closed circuit kind of television, so you'd be watching this infinite tunnel. you know, something like that requires a lot of a lot of care and maintenance. I suppose that we were motivated by the internet, which was changing the way the artists would make work, as well as the way that their work was experienced, documented, circulated, researched, and contextualized. And the same internet was also changing the way that we experienced our relationship to other people, our relationship to products, our relationship to the news and culture. And when I think about it, like without agreeing to it, I began to see the world according to the framework of the internet, things that could be looked up, connected, saved for later, and so on. Feels a little weird, actually, in doing this talk because I'm just so accustomed to thinking in the present. But this is I don't really talk about like a history of the past, and especially what I was thinking about in the past so much. So it feels a little awkward to be to be doing it, but. That's how it is. So we wanted our gallery to engage with the internet on its own terms, not just as an object of critique, but as one of the given inescapable contexts for the work. And like many things taken to their logical conclusions, this brought us to some uncomfortable and unfamiliar conclusions, including ultimately the question of the gallery itself. Rather than talk theoretically, I'll be pretty straightforward from the perspective of someone who is actually both organizing but also working in that gallery, installing it, and sitting with the work for 6 weeks on end. For a typical show, we'd put a lot of work into the opening and then leave the show up for the next 5 or 6 weeks. At this point, the work would be quickly and totally removed from the space so that the next artist had a tabula rasa, set up empty space for their work, which would need to be installed in 1 to 2 weeks, and the whole thing would start over again. And I think we did this, you know, about 30 to 35 times over the course of 5 years. So there's a sort of like intense repetition and the huge amount of stress that goes into an opening. Eventually, I started thinking that maybe this. You know, it wasn't so efficient, at least for us in this gallery. So I remember dwelling on a couple parts of this formula. One, lots of people would come to the opening and very few would come afterwards. I'm going to choose a different slide than Boob Jobs. Kind of doesn't line up right now. So let's say 50% of people came for the first 1% of the show, like night one. You know, then the remaining 50% of the people came for the remaining 99% of the show. It's this kind of like wealth inequalities or something. It's just like a perverse balance. So the gallery usually seemed pretty dead. The work usually wouldn't change at all during the whole period, which again made the place seem pretty dead. Three, when people came to look at the art, they usually stayed an average of 3 minutes, which frankly didn't do much to liven the place up. Four, each artist wanted to rid the traces of previous artists, which I think is totally understandable, but you know, also it has an effect on the place. And it gave me this feeling of a perpetual deja vu, like Groundhog Day or something, that it was always starting again and not sort of like adding up. And five, I wish I had a... could make it, yeah. Five, the space was painted entirely black, which also made it feel pretty dead. somehow the space didn't feel lively, energetic, dynamic, and important as we wanted it to feel, as we were hoping it would. And it wasn't the fault of the artist, because I think the work that we were showing was amazing. It was terrific, and we did ambitious projects with them. It seemed to be something about exhibitions for me. So, and this is where I go into this part of the slides, we embarked on a series of non-traditional forms of exhibitions, trying various strategies for challenging, expanding, and undermining the exhibition. So you start to see like more people in this part of the slides. And things like more participation, more events. We try and schedule talks with the artist or curator, discussion groups, workshops, auxiliary screenings, musical performances in the installations, and so on. And these events would work to bring people back into the gallery, but somehow it just felt like more stuff, more programming, orbiting around the exhibition, and not exactly what we were going for. What we wanted was for the gallery to be a productive space, a place where the art was made, and not simply, you know, received or interpreted, or a sort of place where it's exported from the studio. I think it's kind of commonplace in certain ways at this point. And this project is called Chungking Common in 2006. We'd installed sod on the whole inside of the gallery, built a series of props, which were rocks, let's see, these sort of bench things, a wishing well, a lighting system that was sort of sequenced and choreographed to show different things at different intervals. And there were, again, performances, there were lectures, Fallen Fruit, Dawn Casper, she's doing a performance, or she's dead. She's a dead person in a park. And sometimes these performances and things would be overlapping in time and sometimes in space. And so this is, I guess what I'm saying is that this is the sort of thing that we sort of ended up at, like getting so obsessively thinking about exhibitions so much. I realized eventually that this is not our space. This is in Europe. That there was a parallel kind of practice called new institutionalism. And this term referred mainly to a situation in which mainly like independent curators, like Nicholas Borio and Maria Lind, and Vassif Kortoun, and Charles Esche became the heads of some major cultural institutions. And I'll just quote Charles Esche, who curated this in 2001. He wrote this in 2001. Now, the term art might be starting to describe that space in society for experimentation, questioning, and discovery that religion, science, and philosophy have occupied sporadically in former times. It has become an active space rather than one of passive observation. Therefore, the institutions to foster it have to be part community center, part laboratory, and part academy, with less need for the established showroom function. So I'm bringing this up to sort of say that, like, oh, they were doing it in Europe first. That what we were doing was kind of an echo of what was an ongoing debate in Europe at the time. In addition to shifting the understanding of the institution's audience from spectator to participant, or in the language of that time, from passive to active, which now seems pretty dated, it said that new institutionalism internalized institutional critique. In other words, rather than inviting in artists who would sort of, you know, make a work that critiques the institution, Michael Asher or Andrea Fraser or something, which had become desirable for many institutions, the institutions would already be critical of themselves and act accordingly. So, like, here we have this symposium on the institution itself as a medium, which is kind of what I'm talking about, and curating as already institutional critique, or here's a sort of like more recent version of that, which is an Apple t-shirt, which it speaks for itself. Nina Montman has since written about the fall of new institutionalism, referring to defunding, closures, or personnel replacements. Her theory, like 4 years ago, was that political and corporate interests wouldn't tolerate criticality, so they pulled their support of these things. Nevertheless, this mode of institutional practice now finds itself in the most corporate of cultural institutions.
The BMW Guggenheim Lab is really a mixture between an urban think tank, a community center, and a gathering space.
The lab is really hoping to work on inspiring ideas, but also designs for urban life.
The site for the very first lab in New York is in the border between the East Village and the Lower East Side. It's on First Street between First and Second Avenues, right on Houston.
So the idea is that you take a range of people from wildly different disciplines, throw them together and see if they can come up with new ideas, experiments, and solutions for this problem with the city.
We're trying to explore the tension between private comfort and public comfort.
I see this.
So I'm not going to play the whole thing because I'm trying to stick to the tight ship. But you get the idea. It's difficult to take issue with this video because it's well produced. It's about the community. The program sounds fun and thoughtful and interesting, and everyone's good looking. But at the same time, we also have to consider things like the artistic boycott by dozens of artists right now of the Guggenheim in Abu Dhabi. And for some of those artists, the Guggenheim in any location, over labor practices in the construction of that museum. Or BMW's ongoing battle, because it's a BMW-Guggenheim kind of collaboration, but BMW's ongoing battle with the Teamsters in Ontario, California, which is east of Los Angeles. This is a bit really tugs at the heartstrings.
On August 31, BMW's distribution center, just a mile from here in Ontario, California, advised us that they're going to throw their workforce into the street and replace them with low-wage, non-union, third-party contractors. This after 40 years of faithful service to the company.
So, again, I'm going to cut that short just because of time, but you get the idea. And I think what's interesting there, actually labor kind of comes comes together at a confluence in the videos in kind of an interesting way. But in that one, there's a lot more sort of there's more like nationalism, whereas in the at the end of the BMW Guggenheim one, it's a very like international, like you read about, or they show you how that Guggenheim lab is going to be sort of folded in on itself and then transported to Berlin and then transported to somewhere in Asia, and that it's like a sort of like a roving lab of community intellectual empowerment or something. And so I think that in watching something like that, it's also sort of interesting to look at the way that those same corporations are embroiled in their own kind of conflicts, usually around labor. So anyway, this is taking me off the track a little bit. What I'm trying to say is that our drift, this drift away from objects and exhibitions, is anything but a drift away from, spectacle and the market and towards something more pure. The sort of drift in our exhibition practices. On the contrary, it's fully intertwined with similar changes within the market itself, whether away from products and towards services, experiences, and knowledge, or simply externalizing labor by outsourcing and crowdsourcing, which is the case of BMW in that case. So what does this look like for the artist? Instead of the studio as a kind of factory where the artist produces some number of artworks which may or may not be exhibited and ultimately sold and collected, we have a different situation. Now we have the type of artist who works outside of their studio, who in fact never stops working because they're always giving talks, networking, communicating with curators, self-documenting and self-promoting. It's said that this kind of artist is the paradigmatic cognitive worker, that the things that used to be ours, our free time, our friendships, our creativity, our love, are increasingly put to the service of capital. The obvious example would be our interactions on social networks. So here, Boris Groys, last year published a book called Going Public, which collected a bunch of writings that appeared on eFlux. He writes of our obligation to self-design, where each person must establish his or her own image in the context of visual media. So it's kind of this other job that we have to like construct our image that floats around in these spaces. So the video that I'm about to show is a YouTube account, Hurricane Aubrey. And it became popular when one video called 51 Things in My Room became a meme. And it was featured on the homepage of YouTube, and then a bunch of people also made videos showing some arbitrary number of things in their rooms. So anyway, here's a video of a young woman both fighting with and conscious of her own media image, who sees herself as a producer in relation to spectators who are at the same time her friends. And in a way, I just felt like this video kind of solidified or condensed some of the things I was just saying.
So I thought I would just, you know, come on here and make a little video before all of my subscribers and viewers form a big giant group and try and kill me for not making a video for so long. I've made a video for a while. I know that. I am sorry. I just don't want to make a video because I feel forced to. I want to make videos because I feel like making videos. I like making videos, and you know, sometimes I don't always feel like making a video. Vlog candy every Friday. I have something that I'm supposed to talk about, something I'm supposed to do. I do it. It's supposed to be up every Friday, and I just do it. On this channel, I don't have to post a video, you know, if I don't want to, and I guess I take advantage of that. I guess since I do post on Vlog Candy so much, and I like my Vlog Candy videos so much, this channel, you know what I'm saying? But the main thing is, I don't want to feel forced to make a video. Threatening to unsubscribe and, you know, saying stuff like, "Oh, Aubrey, I like your old videos so much more. I want the old Aubrey back." It doesn't make me want to make videos. Besides those comments, there are a lot of nice comments like, you know, "Oh, Aubrey, I miss you making videos." And, like, those make me want to make videos. I just have no problem blocking people. I used to not block people.
Okay. I was hoping to play it until a part that I'm going to quote, where she makes this comment that it's like school when she's talking about the comments that are coming in. You know, just like, why would I do this? It's becoming like school. You know, like, that's, once it becomes like school, it's a reason not to do something. So just to, which, of course, could just as easily have been, it's like work, right? And I think maybe the difference between school and work in that kind of context would be that, like, maybe the social conflicts are more out in the open in school, and they're kind of in private or repressed at work a little bit. But anyway, the reason I've shown the video is precisely her relationship to her own exhibition, her plea to function according to her own logic instead of an external logic, the demand of others. But also because you can see how the very logic of self-display has confused the boundary between her own desire and those external demands. You know, she kind of complains about it, but wants to also be there complaining about it. We might think of our own image as a kind of factory that we labor inside of, and this isn't far off from what Guy Debord described as a social relation between people that is mediated by images. That's his description of the spectacle. Only now the situation has become more complicated. Back to Boris Groys, the apparent cure for this lulling into sleep by the society of the spectacle is a shock-like encounter with the real that is supposed to rescue people from their contemplative passivity and move them into action, which is the only thing that promises an experience of truth as living intensity. So, I mean, what that basically means is, you know, like, it's a function of the modernist avant-garde. It's this, you know, the kind of like shocking to the normative sensibilities of the time will you know, wake people up into action and to see that the world is an image or something like that. The debate now is only over the question whether such an encounter with the real is still possible, or whether the real has definitively disappeared behind its designed surface. So that's Groys's thing, that there's not really the real. The surface is the real that we should be speaking of, and this idea of like shocking people and you know uncovering something just doesn't quite make sense anymore. Back to Los Angeles, 2007. We become interested in the breakdown between producers and consumers. That was something we were talking about at the time, between art and life. But instead of emancipation, because which some people used to promise, you know, in art and life, the line was blurred, it seemed more like we'd fallen into a whole new form of domination. Against this backdrop, things looked pretty normal, though. Artists were making work in their studios and selling it at galleries for a lot of money in 2007. The housing bubble was still inflating, and our rent was going up in that space I showed you. In the span of 366 days, it went from $1,500 a month to $2,800 a month. And when you're running a sort of like small artist-run sort of space, you know, like $1 extra will break your back, let alone $1,300 extra. It was clear we couldn't stay in our space. This map is actually like all the art fairs at the time in 2007. It used to be an animation, but I lost it. But it just sort of fills in for like a picture of a time, because after that point, they start to pop. They start not being quite as many. But around us, everyone else was doing great. In some cities, gallerists show their success with a big party or a new car. But in Los Angeles, they would do it by opening a gallery in Berlin. Confronted with losing our space in Chinatown, we decided to do the same thing. Open a gallery in Berlin. I realized that I often knew just as much about exhibitions in Berlin as I did in Los Angeles, or anywhere else for that matter, because I didn't go to any of them. I was too busy working. Rather, I read about them on the internet, maybe a magazine, but always through images and press releases. It occurred to me that paying the rent was a wasted effort, that we could simply short-circuit the entire process and just produce images. And so this is a 3D model of our gallery in Berlin, right? We never had it. We just made a 3D model. And we could do some really amazing shows. So this is the artist, Nick Irvink. So we worked with real artists and real architects. A small but successful Berlin-based firm, SMAQ, SMAC, designed it based on a real building, Brunnenstrasse 11, and you know, it all looks more or less right. You know, when we worked with the artists, it was always with the understanding that it would only ever be experienced through the so-called secondary formats of press releases, rumors, websites, advertisements, anecdote, and freely circulating images. This is where we ended up moving to when we had to move out into a basement. So you go down that alley, down into a basement. We've since moved back up, but in another project, we situated televisions and video monitors in various public and semi-private locations around Chinatown. And each month invited artists or curators to choose and make work for them. It was called the Distributed Gallery, another rent-free endeavor. Because it had no fixed location, and because it was also embedded in the life of these other businesses. So I'm going to move into the public school now. I just want to get a gauge on how much time I have. Oh, okay, great. At a certain point in 2007, however, the very idea of exhibition became problematic for us. Rather than providing visibility for the cultural practices we were interested in, which is the basic assumption of exhibition, I think, it more often than not seemed to obscure those practices by imposing a threshold of exhibitability on them. As I said before, mounting, artist statements, openings, and all these kind of things weren't just the peripheral components of an exhibition, but they were the lens through which the work was experienced, and they typically served the expectations of the market more than the work itself. That was the way that that it seemed at the time while we were putting on these exhibitions. About a month after my daughter was born, who's on the first slide, I proposed an idea to some friends, which was to start a school in the basement of our nonprofit. The idea was that the school would have no curriculum. Instead, people proposed things that they wanted to learn about. That's what the diagram is. Or that they wanted to teach, or that they wanted to experience, or that they simply wanted to see happen. Then other people, there's sign-ups up in the top right, could show that they were interested in the idea, and finally the school would figure out some way to turn those proposals, those ideas, into actual classes. It would be an experiment in self-organization, a proposition for a minimal framework that would potentially accommodate anything. Instead of degrees, tests, disciplines, accreditation, goals, and so on, there was an open space for people to propose classes ranging from the extremely practical to the impossible and strange. A majority of the proposals would not happen, like stalking Vincent Gallo. They amounted to a catalog of possibilities, a compendium of need, desire, and imagination. And that one where I'm holding the whips, that's in our S&M class. And that was originally proposed as sadism and masochism, with the description theory and practice, and the person who proposed it had no intention whatsoever of teaching it. So it was just sort of an idea that was thrown into the school, which became wildly popular, and in a way that the school became this effort in figuring out how to offer something like that. After the building the website in January of 2008, I invited many artists that we'd worked with at TELIC over the years to propose classes, something that they would actually go to if it happened. And so that's how we got things like stalking Vincent Gallo. The first event was an orientation or an open house called a Richtfest. In the German tradition, a Richtfest means a construction celebration, I don't have a picture of it, but that wreath up there is like what they'd put it at the top of the building, at the very top of the highest point of the structure. So it's before the building's been completed, but when the structure reaches its highest point, they'd have this party. They'd drink, basically drinking beer at a construction site, which I like the image of. Anyways, the image of celebrating the structure as the idea of something else seemed appropriate, especially when the idea was that everyone there would be participating in the construction of this thing, of the school. By the end, let's say we had all these proposal sheets and things, about 300 people had signed up for classes, and there were more than 90 proposals. The school is both real and virtual, because classes actually do happen. They happen in real space, while proposals for new classes continue to emerge. So there's always this tension between what is and what might be. To be honest, the project began very modestly, just an idea about how to schedule events, really. It was a kind of institutional drag that let us do things that we wouldn't normally do, given our own history as a media arts space and so on, but that we really wanted to do deep down. So like building gray water systems and irrigating fruit trees and stuff. I guess at some level we really wanted to do this kind of stuff and like never felt able to. I want to wrap up by actually reflecting on what's happened over the past 3.5 years since that time. Since the Richtfest, there have been about 1,200 more ideas proposed. And I looked it up last night. 463 have actually been offered as classes. The public school has had a presence in Philadelphia, New York, Durham, Paris, Chicago, San Juan, Brussels, Berlin, Helsinki, and as of last week, in Medellin, Colombia. I don't know if I'll actually talk about this, but if you're getting bored of what I'm saying, you could read that. There's one story about the multiplication of the project as groups and individuals from these various cities have asked to make the project happen where they live, and that's sort of, you know, how it's gone to all these places I just mentioned for whatever reason. Like in New York, there was a fellowship in San Juan. Never been to San Juan, but a group of people who run a space there called Beta Local wanted to do something similar, and so it was a way of supporting people there. And it's different in every place. But there's another story, and that's about the assault on public services worldwide. In California, students see fee hikes, austerity measures in Europe, proposals for a big society in the UK, and you see where that's gotten them. All of this driven by a neoliberal agenda to privatize social wealth through financialization and debt. And this is especially pronounced with for students, because right now I think it's student loan debt is at about $1 trillion. It's more than credit card debt. So, you know, basically people are carrying $1 trillion of debt for their education, and the education is intended to provide social mobility, but actually when it's mounting this much debt, you start wondering what direction that mobility is. So anyway, this has been met by riots, occupations, and protests in Greece, Spain, Italy, the UK, California, Chile, Brazil, Puerto Rico, to name only a few. This is where the slide is supposed to go. How does an ideology-less institution, like the public school, orient itself in this kind of climate? Right? Because the public school is just a framework. It says, propose things. In a way, it's not that different from YouTube. It's a piece of software where people put in content. So how does this project relate to something like that? And it's something that I still think about. But here's one answer, which is the classes are actually we get all these proposals in, and we form committees, and those committees are they rotate. So every few months, people drop off and new people come on. And those people are the ones who choose what classes to organize. And they're the ones who actually do the work of organizing it. And one thing that I'd set up was this idea of position statements, which was every new iteration of the committee would articulate its values at the time. And so the way that I thought about it was, like, if a manifesto would be more like a map for your journey, you know, and you kind of like always consult the map and make sure you're like keeping it real. The position statement would be more like you just sail out, and every so often you figure out where you are and where you want to go. And in a way that sort of ethic seemed to correspond more to the project than some like, you know, really strident manifesto. Yeah, the point is not to have a predefined agenda that is expressed through a curriculum, nor is it to avoid having any agenda. Rather, the point is to produce that. Produce that agenda in the process of the activity of the school, and to allow that agenda to be open to contestation and constant revision. The school as a sort of public sphere and not a walled proprietary institution. I just have 2 pages. Will I make it? Okay. I'm so paranoid about timing. The public school is open in several ways. There's a musical chairs between teachers, students, and administrators. It does not exclude based on age or what discipline you come from. People project their expectations onto it and really try to make it their own. And at the same time, the classes are usually somehow things that can't happen anywhere and in a sense are minor, marginal, or critical. The classes don't really add up any more than a group of people with real difference does. Let me see. Okay. Seeing where I am in the... give you a new picture to look at. A large part of the project is the use of the internet. So unlike the universities, which use online learning to sort of explode the classroom, to get in more students, and you know, so you can sort of sit in your underwear at home and not have to visit a classroom, the public school is kind of the inverse of that, in which the internet's used to gather sort of ideas and organization and actually pull people together. What happens there when they're brought together depends on the people who are there, who are present. There's no real frame, and there's a very real possibility of things not going well. For long, awkward pauses. For questions about what's supposed to happen. Very often, the class discussion bleeds into a discussion of what the public school should be. And the public school continuously remakes itself. There's a class from the beginning called the public school, which is as much an explanation as it is a workshop for operating on the school. Conversations from classes generate new classes, and so on again. each school. Here, it shows like on the map different schools, copies classes from other schools. And this is an important point, and probably where I'd like to conclude. Sharing, copying, open source, this sort of thing. When someone makes a proposal, they don't own it, because others will modify it, copy it, and perform it in unexpected ways. And when that idea takes root in another city, so if someone did S&M in Berlin, you know, it's going to happen differently, whether that's just because there's a different sort of BDSM community, because German goes better or something, who knows? In this way, the public school allows people to both participate locally and exchange internationally. Teachers, students, and organizers have moved between schools. And for me, this has become the most exciting dimension of the project. The articulation of an organized network that is truly international, where people and ideas can move freely outside the exploitative logic of economic exchange, or its obverse, the sort of restricted mobility enforced by the police and the nation state. But to conclude on a note of caution, here we are, for an open source educational project. I think like devil red behind him, it's really perfect. I think that the problem for us and with the public school won't be some sort of aggressive frontal confrontation with power. No one's going to say, like, the public school needs to shut down, you know, or the institution, or anything like that, and the way that oppositional politics usually plays themselves out. So we won't really come into conflict with very much, I don't think. Or even we probably won't have the same fate as the new institutionalism of being sort of choked off at the source, because we don't really, at this point, have a source. On the contrary, it'll probably happen something like this. In 2006, this is Oracle CEO Larry Ellison. He was asked whether open source products were a threat to his business as a for-profit software company, and he said, "We don't have to fight open source, we have to exploit open source." So I think that's the sort of like more likely... Well, anyway, at first it seems like an updated version of the idea of an alternative and selling out, I think, superficially. But in an economy where consumers are seen as producers, I think this is actually a more general condition, and it's not even restricted to artists. That the sort of labor that we do, whether it's making work, which sort of increases property values, you know, by like participating artistically within a neighborhood, or if we're clicking around on Facebook and it's generating real value somewhere else, you know, oftentimes there's value being created and that isn't being captured by the people who are doing the work. So this is sort of what I meant by a general condition. And back to Aubrey, and this is like the conclusion sort of. Aubrey feels as though she is at school or work, and for me the question is, who's the boss? So I'm sorry, this is a bit of a cold end, but I thought it would be better to sort of end like that and then see if there are any questions than to sort of tie it all up neatly. So thank you. No one. That's okay.
On funding for the public schools, is it private funding, or are y'all expecting support from government agencies? And how does that, in either one, would that drive some of the direction that the public schools would be going?
Definitely. I mean, I think unless you're independently wealthy, funding necessarily becomes a sort of like persistent topic of conversation of small sort of self-organized spaces. For us, we're all millionaires, so... for us, The public school has absolutely nothing to do with the public school system, right? It's sort of an appropriation of the name. And we have received funding in the past from the Warhol Foundation, like sort of with our legacy as an art space, although not much of that went to the project of the public school. The way that it actually works now in Los Angeles is that we charge for classes. Usually it's about $5 a meeting. Sometimes with technical classes, we'll charge more and say it's a fundraiser. But we try and be transparent about the sort of what's required to pay the operational costs, and then say that when you're paying for a class, you're not paying for the service of learning something, but you're simply contributing to the sustainability of that situation of paying the rent, insurance, utilities, and so on. So we pay $1,400 total a month, you know, between all those things. And we just sort of try and make it clear to people, we need to raise this money, and this is why we're asking for donations at classes, and it tends to go just fine. But that's in Los Angeles. I think that we are actually the only one of the schools that charges anything for classes. Everyone else, you know, has their own peculiarities. I think with some of the schools in Europe, you know, they're a little bit more subsidized by institutions that kind of support them. In New York, it's been a little bit different. In New York, the public school, Triple Canopy, and Light Industry are three excellent organizations that sort of share a space. And in that way, you know, rather than being three spaces, three institutions with three spaces, they sort of combine efforts. I don't know if that's like getting really addressing what you're really asking, because I have a tendency to actually ramble on in excessive detail when it comes to funding. But is it?
Sort of. I was just curious.
Oh, you were curious about the like influence of funding.
Right now, it's, you know, it seems early on disintegrating, you know, the years, but as it becomes broader internationally, how, you know, just like we have public schools here, and it is affected by, you know, the money that's available from cities and states.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would say that anyone who is unaffected by who claims to be unaffected by the money that they're receiving would be deceiving themselves at some level. And I don't doubt that our sort of financial model of needing to like ask for money at classes probably has some effect on the way that it runs and everything. But actually, the effect that it's had for us is to just bend over backwards to explain where people's money is going. So in a certain sense, that's been sort of the effect. And to get to, I mean, I think you bring up another actually, well, for me it's interesting, which is this idea of growth and scale. And it seems to me that there's like a few ways that things can scale. And one is to quite literally grow. And that would mean that the space has to get bigger because the audience are getting bigger, and then you need more money to pay for the bigger space. And, you know, so everything kind of just goes like that. But actually, we've been trying something else with the public school, which is we found that there's actually kind of a nice size. You know, conversations aren't that good when there's more than 15 people. And they're not that good when there's less than three people. So we aim like somewhere in that range for most of our classes. And that means that like we don't think about growing very much. Rather, the growth is more this kind of multiplication. And so, I mean, this comes up sometimes when talking about documentation, which is that, you know, a lot of times people will say, will you broadcast that class, right? Because it seems really interesting. And there's this idea that, like, we're doing a class and it needs to spread to as big an audience as possible. And I don't know, I've been of the position to say, no, we're not going to broadcast it. Because, technically, like, when we fumble around with stuff, it just gets in the way. Like, we aren't capable of doing it. We, screw everything up. But B, what seems more in the spirit of the project for me would be to encourage them to do it themselves where they are, and to not sort of like rely on the idea that there's some center that needs to grow and include them, but to simply say provide them the materials and resources to do something. So. Oh, a lot of hands now. Uh-oh. Do I have to do it? Oh. He's the oldest one.
I love this idea of institutional drag, and so it seems to me that part of the project is precisely, well, drag tells us more about what it's spoofing than say the copy tells us more of the about the original. And in part of the spoof, which is wonderful, is you're looking at actually data analysis, right? You're really working like a corporation. And it seems to me that the public school is actually about experience. So the real question is, if you're creating experience, what is it? You're also creating a new spectator or possibly a consumer. What is it they are actually looking for in a public school? And how do you account for that in the way the structure or the organism itself begins to transform or change?
So your question is, What kind of subjects are we producing, or
you must have contact with those who come to the public school.
Yeah.
You must have a sense that after some years of doing this,
what they want. Yeah.
I mean,
okay.
Because art spectators go for one thing, right?
Right.
And now you're kind of creating new spectators, right?
Yeah.
Or they're coming to you.
Or something, yeah, new public.
New public.
Or because yeah, they're sort of united in Not universally, but in not being spectators, you know. And I think that's like
that's getting art world people is what I'm concerned
about,
right?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, we continue to want to support the artistic community and to think that actually artists really want a space to talk about. To learn new things or to talk about new things, but also we don't want it to sort of inhibit people before they even walk in. And that's why it has such a kind of generic name, the public school, because people, you know, basically everyone kind of feels welcome once they have a basic understanding of what it is. No one feels left out. But your question is, like, what are people looking for when they come? And that, there's obviously, as you could probably guess, there's no simple answer. Some people are looking, like, really, like, instrumentally to learn a new skill. Maybe because they think it'll help them get a new job. Other people are looking for something to fill in the gap, to fill in that void that's left because they just finished school, you know, and they... there's a lot of things that school provides that are really nice, like social networks, a certain type of community, and when the structure of school is pulled out, then you often have students who want to sort of replicate that for themselves. Sometimes you have people who are even further along who I always think about the fact that like a institutionalized education pretty much brings you up to about age 22. You know, on average, because now more or less on average people go to college. Some people go a little bit further, some people go a little bit less, but 22. And that leaves like 50 years at least in the average lifespan where people like have no kind of education. And that tends to be the period of time where people become more sort of certain of their ideas. And so on. So some people sort of, I think, just simply want to keep learning things. Like, and then other people are brought in by one class and one class only. You know, some people like the idea of it and just want to be part of that culture, and other people come in because we're talking about the Egyptian Revolution and its historical context, and they just want to know about that because it's been in the news for the past week, right? And so that they come to something like that. And we try and accommodate all those different things. And in an ideal world, we'd be sort of like diverting them into other classes, right? To get them to do things that they wouldn't normally want to be doing, simply because that's the kind of like public, I guess, that we're sort of privileging, that we're trying to construct.
Could you maybe address how that played out in Nineveh, where I see that project that you just came from being much more theoretical, and that you didn't actually produce the classes, you put that out there for people mm-hmm. to think about what they want to know.
Mm-hmm.
Could you just talk a little bit about, like, I think that kind of goes to Roberto's, like, it is hard to say who your public is because it's so diverse, and it has to do with your situation.
Right. I'm trying to think about the way to, like, answer that in a concise way without getting into the whole history of Medellin. But the project that we did, and we is Fiona, myself, and Caleb, it was called A Public School. And the idea was we were sort of invited to start a school in the way that we've started some of these other like schools in other cities. But something felt weird about that because it was a biennial context, and being sort of invited in to start a school in a biennial context without any real demand from the community, just it's not the way that it works. So we went down and did a research trip and met with a bunch of groups and everything. And actually everyone in the groups was saying, like, it would be really great if this project was here. But we figured that actually, because we don't speak Spanish, so it was a project conducted entirely in Spanish, even though we don't speak Spanish. And it's a very, like, spread out city, very localized, and also, like, really complicated because of the history of drugs and violence and civil war and displacement. Like, it's a really intense kind of situation. So ultimately, what we proposed was that we were going to focus on the first part of the public school, the experience of the public school in Los Angeles, which was collecting proposals, which is to conjure up this sort of like image of what this school could be, and to publish it as a newspaper, and to distribute it, and to sort of bring together various parts of the city, various ideas from different ages and locations, to publish them all together, and then leave it at that. And to sort of like see if people would begin asking, like, when's this going to happen? Like, what do we need to do to make this happen? And that this is already kind of starting to happen. But the project was to create an image, to create the imaginary, or to generate the imaginary, which is already there. Like, because there are ideas from all the people who are already living there. So the sort of imaginary is already kind of latent, and it's just a matter of like trying to publish it, to bring it together, to make it visible, and to see what happens from there. And if that sort of, you know, like if like imagination can sort of like will itself into reality.
Can you give like three different proposals just to get a sense of
from
how it works and how just the proposals alone reflect so much about the community?
So one was first aid. Now, like, it'd be really good to learn first aid in my community. Another one was robot heads. And like robots that learn how to cut hair. There's another one about paragliding and parasailing, and it was a little bit lost in translation, but it was something about forgetting that I don't have a job by like flying through the air or something like that. And another one was how to survive on the streets. And it was quite literally like, I want someone from the streets to like teach me what it takes, what to look out for, like really practical stuff, like what types of people I should look out for, how I should carry myself, what I need to do to survive on the streets, because actually that's a really handy skill for someone who has to spend time walking down the streets of Medellin. So the I mean, and then there were like kids who were saying who would sign, put things like, "I want to be a, I want to do graffiti and surgery," you know. And so they were like proposing what they imagined their own future to be, rather than like, you know, specific classes. So people kind of approached it in really different ways, and it, the proposals kind of capture a lot of that. I have a couple copies of the paper, so if someone's like really would like it afterwards, then I'm happy to give it to you, but I've only got like three in my bag. So, so if everyone who has their hands up, maybe we could just like get everyone to ask the question, then maybe I could tie them together or something like that. I don't know. I mean, just because otherwise people feel left. So, sure, you first.
So I'm just wondering if there's a relationship between your project and the machine project in LA.
Uh-huh.
And the United Nations Plaza.
Yes to the first one, no to the second one. We share a lot of that. Sorry, I meant to, but it was so quick. We share all the, like, we share a lot of the same people. We go to each other's stuff. We're just sort of comrade projects in LA. And, you know, LA has a really great kind of culture of these types of projects, and they're pretty supportive of one another. So...
Okay, this is going back to your exhibition space. You're talking about this whole idea of new institutionalism and less about the showroom mentality and more about the space to gather and talk about ideas. How do you feel, or do you have any thoughts on institutions that are now, you know, living on the internet? They've got, as in museums that have Twitter accounts and blogs and Facebooks, and kind of the space that, how do you feel like that space should be used?
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I just get the other questions that there are, and then I'll try and, okay, yes.
Your criteria for the courses that you want to teach or that you want to accept for the curriculum says that you don't really insist upon, or you're trying to de-emphasize the teaching of skills that have economic consequences. I mean, that was one of your criteria. You're not trying to teach someone like how to be a computer programmer or how to be a language teacher, okay? Now what happens if somebody comes to you and says, I'd like a course so I could become a computer programmer or so I could become a language teacher? Do you tell them to go to some place that's interested in that, or do you try to accommodate?
Okay. Before I go into those, or was there any other ones? Oh gosh, I'm not going to be able to keep five of mine. So I'll just do these two. The answer is pretty much we direct them to what already exists in the city, if there's something that already exists in the city. But if it turns out, and this is like, here's an example, is WordPress. WordPress is a kind of, you know, if you know it, you could probably get a couple jobs doing computer websites for people. So it's very practical in a certain way. But a lot of artists wanted to know it in order to like build their own portfolio websites. And so in that case, even though that there might be other places for them to learn WordPress, it was important enough to people who were already circulating within the school that we thought it would be a good idea because it fulfilled a need that was there. But yeah, if someone sort of approaches with no knowledge of anything and just sort of approaches the school and says, I'd like to get certified for, you know, such and such database, and like, you know, we can't do that, and we just direct them somewhere else. So we try and deflect people. As for the question of how institutions now are using, how are they using the internet, and what are like better and worse ways of using the internet for them? That's a good question. Like, I remember LACMA started dumping on tons of its history, like PDFs of old books and stuff, and I thought that was really exciting, and. You know, do you know Lauren Cornell from Rhizome? So she just wrote something for Freeze, which I thought was interesting, that I think addresses the question. And I would defer to her, because Rhizome is an online platform is doing, I think, exactly what it is that you're asking. But from my point of view, it would just be like if institutions used the medium like they liked it, rather than like they were just doing a job to publicize stuff. You know what I mean? Like, if they used it like they were really into it, like they, you know, if they hired people who were just like combing the internet and combing their archives and publishing like the really awesome stuff that there is out there and sharing it with people, then that would probably create a dynamic, like, attractive space. But because most people can tell when they're just reading publicity, you know? So, I don't know. So maybe there were like three other people? Okay, so I'll try those three, see if that works.
I guess mine was more of a connecting thought, is that because I teach and I just saw that what you've developed, or that what I see happening is that people get a sense of intimacy in what they do, rather than, I can go on YouTube, and I do, you know, go on there, how do I do this? But there's nothing that extrapolates, like being with another group of people and jumping off from what they know. And so my thought was that the wealth that you gather is what you're spreading out. And the connections that are going on. We're losing that. The children are losing it. They're having whatever you want to call that kind of relationships in the web. They're losing their intimacy. And so I think that I'm excited to hear that you've got a forum where people can talk to people. Yeah, mano a mano. That's amazing. And I'm glad to see that, you know, you're keeping that secret.
Mm-hmm. This is kind of a question for your opinion on life. Earlier you were talking about how you had your art gallery and how you started seeing things that you didn't like about the gallery listed off. And it was like, well, all the lashes and this, people were staying, people really weren't coming after the first opening. And so my question is, when you like transform your work into like participatory art, and like you started going out and like seeing what other people are doing, other people in Europe, how they have people, or like you had like people from the top, people like performing things as opposed to like still life art, and I guess because the traditional art gallery is something that's been around for so long, and obviously if it's been around for so long, it has worked, but I guess now it's kind of losing its popularity. And so my question is, what is your opinion on the reason for that? Like, is it the different, like a change in the culture, and like the audience doesn't appreciate that kind of art anymore? Or is it another kind of reason for that occurrence?
Okay. And I'll just take all the questions now.
I was just interested in the particularity of your network's geography, like places like LA, New York, Philly, and then Berlin and Paris and all that. And I'm just interested in if you think that they're. So there's a reason for those particular sites as opposed to places like Fort Worth or Tucson or St. Louis or Omaha, you know, like, and I'm saying this because, like, knowing a lot of these alternative spaces and practices is that they do tend to be within those other cities, and I wonder what you think about that.
Okay. And then,
what? Could you imagine the public school model in a university setting as either a complement or subversive to the institution?
So those are three interesting ones. The first one is really complicated for me to try and... for one, I would sort of take issue with the idea that galleries are unpopular, because they're still really popular. Certainly, like, after a conceptual art performance, you know, like we're at a point where people are doing a type of practice, and sometimes the gallery just can't accommodate that, and so there needs to be other forms, or when they try and accommodate it, sometimes it doesn't work so well and people get unhappy. But I don't think that means that galleries are unpopular. I think that galleries and objects continue to be pretty popular. And then there's the whole question of the biennial circuit, which often kind of showcases another sort of type of art practice, and certainly makes it more visible than it had been before. And certainly, maybe it makes it seem more visible than it really is, you know, or more important than it is because it becomes more visible. But, you know, in terms of tying all these things together into an answer, I couldn't possibly do it. Really, from my point of view, is just dealing with what our situation was and the way that I was feeling about that situation, and just trying to assess how that went. And I think that if anything, I would think that it's not like it got better and better, and like we're almost there. We've almost got the perfect space, you know, the one that like really does it all. I think it's that, you know, the situation changes, needs change, people change, the times change, you know, because the world right now is really different than, you know, it was in 2006, 2007 even. And so rather than thinking that it's like we're getting to something perfect, I think it's just a matter of like understanding the situation where we are. And, but that's a total non-answer to your question. Cities, yeah, I mean, so there's a school in Durham, North Carolina, right? But it works there because there's obviously three universities. And so there's a bunch of people, and it sort of requires a certain like refreshing, I think, because otherwise things can stagnate a little bit. And obviously big cities have that, like just that, it's like a ocean just washing on shore and pulling back, and it's just like new people all the time. And I don't actually understand, I mean, I always thought Dallas is a pretty big city, so. I mean, I don't understand the situation here, like, quite enough to say, like, it would work, it wouldn't, you know? Like, it pretty much works where a lot of people want it to work. But I think that one thing that big cities have is they have people always coming through, and when those people come through, then sometimes we can pluck them from whoever's brought them through and get them into our orbit. And we have to talk them into doing it for free, maybe. But there's that possibility in a place where, like, every week there's six things happening. Like, it's maybe easier to try and cherry-pick the other institutions and build stuff around that. And I don't know how something like that would work here. I mean, you have people coming in on Tuesday nights, at least. And finally, the question about being a part of a university, I don't think it would work for a lot of reasons, but one reason I think it wouldn't work is because I think people in universities would really like it. Yeah. And by that I mean, like, we don't pay ourselves, we don't pay the teachers. It's kind of like it's not a model to emulate, you know? Like universities do something. They at least like give some insurance, and they do pay people and that kind of thing. Like, we don't do any of that. And that's why I think that universities would really like it, because they're in the middle of trying to figure out how to cut costs and be more innovative with their class offerings and all these things. And so generally, whenever there's this possibility of the public school sort of acting as a model for the future of the university, then I say, hell no, you know, that's sort of the worst possibility. That means that suddenly we've reached a point where nobody's being paid. So in a way, like, the public school is not a model especially for universities. It's simply a thing that we're doing now to make the most out of the situation that we're in, right? It's a contingent. It's not like it's not the future, or it'd be a very dark future in a way. That's not to say that what we do isn't exciting or great or anything like that. It's just that I think that, you know, some care needs to be taken with thinking about what we are wishing for with our universities, especially now where, you know, in California, fees went up 32%, another like 11%, another 6%. Like every 6 months, it seems like they're just raising fees again. And then people have these forced, they have to take time off and not get paid, and they're taking pay cuts, and libraries are being closed, and all these kinds of things. And I'd hate to see like the public school somehow enabling that or something like that. Well, that seems pretty good. Thank you.